All right. Well, this is the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for the 26th of April, 2017. Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis are the facilitators, and Craig McKee, the secretary, and we will proceed with the roll call. Go ahead, Craig.
All right. I'll read the people that I have. I think I have everybody written down here. Myself, Cheryl Curtis, David Cole, James Hufford, Ken Freeland, Peter Ketchum, Xander Arena, Barbara Honegger, Nita Renfrew, Barry Zwicker just joined, Sheila Casey, Charles Ewing Smith, Ryan Hess, John O'Malley, Frank Tolopko, Carl Golovin. Carl, can I just double check the spelling of your name? Is it Golovin? Is Carl there? Or is he muted? Perhaps he's muted.
I was muted. Sorry. Yes, that's correct.
So it's Carl with a K.
Yes, correct.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sue Serpa and Wayne Costi. Did I miss anyone?
I just wanted to check. Frank, you're not coming in under is Sheila Casey on the call?
You have what?
I think you're coming in as Sheila Casey here, Craig. I just wanted to.
Oh.
I don't think Sheila's actually on the call.
I don't think so.
Well, I'm under my own name, so how does that work?
I don't know. It just Anita came on and she came under Sheila Casey's name too. I don't know why. So it's
Anita. Okay. All right. Okay. That's weird. Yes, we'll have to.
Under Sheila Casey, because I'm from calling from my own phone.
Well, yeah, Sheila gets frowned.
I've never heard of Sheila Casey.
And she's not
well,
even on
she's
call,
been on other calls. I guess we wrote down her name under your number. I guess so. We'll
Maybe.
Take Sheila off the. So we go. But did I get everybody off though? Sounds like
okay. If everybody's heard the name mentioned, then I think we're ready to proceed with the. Approval of the minutes from the previous meeting. Are there any amendments to the minutes as circulated by Craig?
Yeah, Frank Tolopko here. I was in attendance on the last call, so I just for the record, I'd like to be added back in.
Okay, we'll make sure we get you added in on the final version of the minutes.
Okay.
Great.
And Craig, you'll hopefully get those to me pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'll get that to you.
Thank you. Any other amendments or modifications to the minutes? Hearing none, and we'll take the minutes for approved as amended and move on to our draft agenda for tonight. Everyone has seen that, presumably. Any amendments to the draft agenda? Any modifications suggested? Hearing none, then we will adopt it and proceed. And our first guest tonight is Peter Ketchum, for the first time being our star feature, and here to introduce him, my co-facilitator, Cheryl Curtis. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yes. So Peter Michael Ketchum, he worked for NIST for 14 years, from 1997 to 2011. He was initially with the High Performance System and Service Division, and then moved into the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division. He was not involved in the NIST investigation of the collapse of World Trade Center 7, but was aware that it was going on. And in July of 2016, he began to look into it and had some questions. And he started sharing his concerns about it with a letter to the editor of the Europhysics News Journal. And that started him on his path, and he's here to tell us about where that's taken him and what he's learned. So, Peter, thank you for coming on, and welcome.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me. And, Cheryl, I just want to verify I've got 15 minutes to speak. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And then we'll do a Q&A after that.
Okay. And you record the conversation, right, which is fine. I just want to make sure that I'm very careful with my words because I realize that this is recorded and other people can listen to it in the future. Is that
right.
correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So what I thought I would talk about is essentially what I would call the backstory. Because anyone who wants to, you know, read my letter to the editor of Europhysics News or watch a few of the videos about me on YouTube can do that. But what doesn't really show up in any of this is what path did I take that eventually led me to all this? So I'm going to give you the backstory, and some of these details may seem not very relevant at first, but I think by the time I get to the end, you'll see how all these pieces eventually all fit together. So I was born and raised in Wisconsin, and for college, I went to Michigan State University, and I had a great interest in science and computing and mathematics, and actually had a rather tough time figuring out exactly what I was going to major in. I started off with chemistry because I thought that's what I wanted to do, and I switched to physics, and then I dabbled with computer science for a while, but eventually decided that mathematics was really my true love and that's what I was going to get my bachelor's degree in, and that is exactly what I did. During my senior year, of course, recruiters, companies came onto campus to recruit, and math majors were not in terribly big demand, but I did get an interview with a company called Cray Research in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And those of you who are familiar with the history of computing may recognize that name, but for those who don't, Cray Research, in its day, was the world's foremost supercomputer maker. And having a Cray computer was very prestigious. They were very expensive. Generally, only very large corporations and governments could afford them. And they were far faster than anything else available at the time. They were primarily used for scientific and technical computing, things like atmospheric modeling, computational fluid dynamics, what else? Various scientific and technical number crunching type things. So I went to work there. I worked mainly with the scientific and mathematical software libraries. Eventually, I decided I needed more computer science background, and I began to take computer science courses at the University of Minnesota. Eventually, I stayed at Cray Research for 4 years. I then wanted to spend more time in graduate school, and I got a part-time job at a place called Minnesota Supercomputer Center, and they had a very tight relationship with Cray Research and the whole supercomputing industry that existed in the Twin Cities in those days. And this was a really great position for me. I got to work half-time, and I got to, you know, take courses at the university in the math department, which was just on the other side of it. The Twin Cities campus is sort of broken into a left bank and a right bank on the Mississippi River, but the point is this all worked out very swimmingly for me. And it was more of this high performance in scientific computing. Eventually, then, I did get accepted into graduate school in the math department at University of Minnesota, and stayed there quite a while, really, really longer than probably would be typical, but I had it in my head that I was going to go back into industry, and I wanted to get as many math courses under my belt as I could. In the middle of all that, I decided that I should get some industry experience. I'd been a teaching assistant there in the math department, and I felt that if I was going to go back into industry, I really should get some industry experience again. And at that point, Minnesota Supercomputer Center was really sort of on its last legs, and that was not an option. And I instead found a job with a company called Secure Computing Corporation. And that company turned out to be rather short-lived. But what I did there is actually rather key. I was brought into their mathematical methods group, and they were working with developing secure operating systems and proving the security properties of operating systems. And they were using a technique called formal methods. As it turned out, I only was there 9 months, and then a bunch of us got laid off. This was around 95, 96. This was in the days when, you know, the internet was just starting to really start to gain steam, and web browsers were becoming, I don't know, some of you may remember the Mosaic web browser. Some of this was just starting to gather steam, and this was one of the first examples I had personally been involved with where there was a big IPO and the stock shot up, and then several months later the stock starts tanking and the management panics and a bunch of people get laid off. And that's what happened to me. I then spent a few months, I sort of had to regain my footing. I hadn't finished graduate school, and I went to work for a company called Interim Technology, which did mainly mainframe computing consulting, and I worked on a Y2K conversion project, which, of course, at that time was a big deal. Everyone was afraid of what was going to happen in year 2000. Then I went back to, I got my job back, my teaching assistantship back at the University of Minnesota Math Department, and by the next spring in 97, I'd completed my master's and was deciding, okay, what am I going to do now? And NIST came, again, math majors weren't in, like, big demand. And most people who get a math degree in graduate school get a PhD and go on to be a college professor. That's probably the most common thing. But that's really not what I wanted to do, and I had a master's. So that wasn't an option anyway. But NIST came to the University of Minnesota to recruit. And I remember seeing the job description. I had been job hunting in sort of like the Career Center one night, and there was this like binder. There was all these binders of like job openings from various employers. I don't even remember the details, but somehow I ended up opening this binder and stumbled across this job opening from NIST, and it was, you know, dealing with high performance and scientific computing, just right up my alley. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is like a dream job. So I had the interview on campus. That went well. They invited me out to Gaithersburg, Maryland, which is where NIST is located, just outside of Washington, D.C. As it happened, the computer security division then also wanted to interview me. And I ended up having two interviews there. The computer security division offered me a job on the spot. But that's not really what I wanted. I wanted the other division, the high-performance systems and services division. And within a couple of weeks, I got a job offer from the high-performance systems and services division. And at the time, I felt like I had won the lottery. I couldn't believe I'd got the job. It was as if I was meant to be there. That's all I can say. It was as if I was just, everything just fell into place. And what is rather interesting is the group leader who hired me, my group leader was my immediate supervisor, she had seen this little bit on formal methods that I had done at that brief amount of period of time at Secure Computing. It was something I almost didn't even put on my resume because I thought no one would care, no one would be interested, but something told me to include it. And that was the thing that like sparked her interest in me. Once I got to NIST, although I really didn't go very far with that formal methods thing and was actually rather quickly moved over to scientific visualization. The group that I was in was called the Scientific Applications and Visualization Group, and we would assist researchers with their scientific codes on the supercomputing systems that NIST had at the time. I spent some time working on some parallel computing standards. Of course, NIST is greatly involved in standards. and there was a particular standard on how involving how you use multiple processors on computers that have multiple processors, which at the time was not as common as it is today. Anyway, I started working in scientific visualization, and I had never done that before, but I really took to it, and it worked really well. I was working with some physicists doing a quantum physics simulation, and that project turned out to be very successful. Like we got some magazine covers of our visualizations. So we had like a 2-page spread in Scientific American, and management was just like very happy with me. And that was when I received a bronze medal award. And NIST is in the Department of Commerce, and Department of Commerce has a bronze, silver, and gold medal award that they give out each year. The silver and gold are determined by Department of Commerce, but NIST decides who is going to get a bronze medal award each year. And it probably goes to about maybe 1% of the employees each year. And it's the bronze medal award is the highest award that NIST presents. It's the highest honor they offer. So I was flying pretty high then. I had been there 3 years. I got this bronze medal award. And that scientific visualization, one of the images I did, really caught the eye of the public and business affairs person. And she decided to use that as this sort of social media icon. And it's still in use today. If you go to this like Facebook page or Twitter page or LinkedIn page, you'll see sort of this colorful, I don't know how to describe it, it's this multicolored sort of image. And that came directly from the work I did, which these days I find somewhat like humorous and ironic. But I guess like all good things, they come to an end. And I started having increasing disagreements with my group leader about scientific visualization. She wanted to go into it in a direction I really didn't want to go and didn't think was a good idea. And also at that time, management decided they didn't really want to do supercomputing so much anymore. And they disbanded the division I was in, the High Performance Systems and Services Division. And they moved my group into a math division. The official name was Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division. At least that was the name at the time. We thought this was a great move. Everyone thought this was going to work out really well. In practice, I don't think it worked that great. My group that I was in was never really fully integrated into the rest of the division because the rest of the division was pretty much all mathematicians, and my group really wasn't. Anyway, I started having increasing disagreements with my group leader. I eventually wrangled myself to get into another group within the division. It was the mathematical modeling group. There was a time there where I served as chair of we had a seminar series, an applied mathematics seminar series, and I served as chair of that for 3 years, which I actually really liked. I would, you know, arrange the speakers and introduce them and host the event. But to make a long story short, after I moved into the math division, it just never really was a very good fit for me. And I tried for years to make it work. But eventually I realized I was banging my head against the wall. And I did leave then NIST in 2011. I came back then to Wisconsin and went through quite a difficult time. Many of the skills that I had sort of acquired over the years were not really in demand anymore. And I had gotten into a bit of a bubble working at NIST, which is not uncommon, and had sort of lost touch with what was happening in the world around me. But I did eventually regain my footing and decided to eventually, after dabbling in a few different things, make my way into mobile application development. Which I know.
Peter, we're at 15 minutes, so
okay.
If you could bring it to
Yeah, I've got about one more minute here. So that brings us up then to July 2016. And I went to Minnesota for the day to visit a friend of mine, actually someone that I had met 30 years earlier at Cray Research, or almost 30 years earlier at Cray Research. And during this lunch, we just talked about all sorts of things. But it was on that lunch that she just said, you know, did you know that there's sort of, you know, increasing evidence that what we thought we knew about 9/11, the World Trade Center collapses, may not be quite what we thought it was? Well, that was, I guess, the one little piece of information I was meant to have. And I thought about it for about a month. And a month later in August, I started investigating it on my own. And that pretty much brings you up to date with how I got to where I am now.
Well, great. That was a great summary of your backstory. And what we'll do now is go into our question and answer mode. If anybody wishes to ask a question, you just press star 6, and you'll be queued in to ask a question. In the meantime, Peter, I'd like to ask you if you could just say a few words about how your critique has been received both within and without the professional community, and where you plan to go with it. Oh, I'm sorry. I think Peter got muted here. Hang on a second, Peter. You're on mute, Peter. Yeah, start over again, please.
Okay. So which professional community did you?
Meaning within NIST and then just in the larger truth community.
Oh, okay. Well, first regarding NIST, I've had absolutely no contact with NIST. Since this investigation of mine or my involvement with the 9/11 truth movement began, I guess you could say last August when I started researching this, I've had absolutely no contact with NIST. The only exception is that I had some friends there. Some of those friends have since left NIST in the intervening years. I now have a very small number of people that I still know there, maybe two or three. And these are not people I communicate with on a regular basis. They're people I might send a note to or receive a note from maybe once every year or two or something like that. And so I have had no discussion with anyone at NIST in any way about this. I have no idea what they're thinking, to tell you the truth, or if they even know about what's going on or what they think about it. What I can tell you is sort of the reactions I get on places like Facebook and YouTube, because I read the comments there. And in general, I would say the comments have been far more, I expected to be raked over the coals, vilified, demonized. That has not happened. It's been far more positive than I expected.
Okay. All right, so we have a couple of folks that would like to ask questions, and the first is Barbara. Go ahead, Barbara.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thank you so much for coming on our call. I have my name is Barbara Honegger, and I have two questions. Okay. The burning one I have is, in your former position at NIST before you went to the math division, when I believe you said you were in something like scientific visualization, would that have been the department that did the simulation, the false simulation of the collapse of the towers in World Trade Center 7? My first question. My second is, maybe you feel you've already told us, but I would like to hear more about what was the very first thing that you looked at that got you involved in 9/11 Truth. Was it your friend, this person you talked to, a woman I believe mentioned it wasn't quite what we thought. But after that, what were the really burning data points that convinced you that the official NIST simulation and claims were false? So those are my two questions.
Okay, so to answer your first one, so I was in the what was called the Information Technology Lab. The NIST is divided up into various labs, much like a university would be divided up into departments. So I was in the Information Technology Lab, and then within that, I was initially in the High Performance Systems and Services Division, and later the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division. As far as I know, neither of those divisions had any involvement with the simulation that was produced. I think you mean in the simulations of the collapses of World Trade Center 7.
Right. Yes, that's what I meant. And if not, what do you think the division would have been that produced it?
I've looked through the list of contributors to the World Trade Center investigation. Most of them are from like the Fire Research Division or the Metallurgy Division, or what was at one time the Metallurgy Division. It's heavily weighted more towards the engineering and material science. It's heavily weighted towards engineering, the engineering staff, the material science staff, and the fire research staff. Now, that being said, there is one person from my former division who is listed as a contributor to the investigation, but that's the only one that I've ever seen.
And was that person part of the scientific visualization group?
Pardon? The division that I was with at the time I left NIST was the Mathematical and Computational Sciences Division.
Right.
And there was one person from my division who is listed as a contributor to the World Trade Center investigation.
Right. Okay.
Go ahead. Did that answer your question, your first question?
What I'm trying to get at is scientific visualization. I believe you used words to that effect towards the beginning.
Yep.
And do you think they would have been involved? Somebody has to do the actual visualization simulation, not necessarily engineers. That's a different expertise. So I'm just wondering if you have any idea if someone from that division was involved in doing the simulation, or maybe we don't know.
Well, I scientific visualization would be, I think in this case, would be somewhat distinct from an engineering visualization or an engineering animation.
I see.
The animations that I have seen of the collapses, I'm pretty confident are coming from some very commonly used engineering software packages, finite element packages.
Okay.
And those are seen as engineering type animations.
I understand the difference now, yes. Okay. As opposed to your quantum mechanical,
Because it's not
reaction.
They're not really doing scientific research in the way one would think of that. It is much more about engineering.
Okay. And then thank you. And my other question, I'm sure we're all very interested, is what are a couple of the real burning data points that caused to realize, oh, my God, they're right?
Yeah, it was one night in August. I don't remember what triggered me, but it was just the sense of, I was kind of like, I'm going to go look up this World Trade Center NIST thing. And I pulled up YouTube and just started typing in a few keywords just to see what would come up. And sure enough, I discovered there were all these like videos and a whole community involved in this that I had no idea existed. And one of the first things, I also was very surprised that NIST was as prominently, that NIST's role was as prominent as it was in the 9/11 truth movement. I thought that the report that NIST had done had simply been done, no one cared about it, and it got put on a shelf and collected dust. I had no idea that it was as relevant and as well known as it was. And
okay.
That evening I also downloaded the NIST NC Star 1 and 1A and started reading through bits and pieces of them.
Okay, so what was the most credible information that brought you around? Did you you ended up on Sherrod Architects and Engineers because you were focused on the World Trade Center?
Yeah, you know, at first there was, of course, like a widely varying quality of some of these videos I was watching, and some seemed credible and some not so much. And I remember saying to myself, where are the technical experts on this? Where are the architects? Where are the engineers? Where, you know, I kept saying, where have they weighed in on this? And what do they think of this?
Uh-huh.
Well, sure enough, I stumbled upon Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. It was like, okay, this is exactly what I was looking for. And of course, then
and they were looking for you.
Well, yeah, we didn't know that at the time, but I certainly was like, oh, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. This is an organization that I want to find out what they have to say about this.
Okay, thank you very much. That answer.
Yep.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. And we'll go to our other questioner, who is Xander Arana. Go ahead, Xander. Xander
Arana? Hi, sorry. Getting off mute, sorry. All right, Peter, my question for you is, my understanding of the WTC-7 investigation, and I think also the earlier ones on the Towers 1 and 2, is that they were largely run by contractors through SAIC. And I'm curious, in your experience working at NIST, how often were contractors from other private corporations or other federal entities utilized by NIST to accomplish their tasks? Was it unusual to have SAIC involved so extensively in the World Trade Center investigation?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In the areas that I worked in, sort of the mathematics and the scientific visualization, we rarely had any involvement with contractors. I would have to really rack my brain to think of any example where that occurred. Now, in other areas like the computer security division, they did have people that were contractors from places like Booz Allen Hamilton and, I don't know, some of these other big contractors. They did, in those cases, sometimes have contractors that they worked with. And my guess is that funds had to be specifically earmarked for that sort of thing. Because I was never involved in that stuff, I don't know the details. But in the World Trade Center investigation, I also get the sense, looking through the official report, that there's all these contractors, you know, SAIC and Underwriters Lab, and there's contractor after contractor after contractor. I don't know why they're, you know, when I looked at all that, I thought to myself, well, what's NIST's purpose then? I mean, I thought, well, if NIST isn't doing this, why even involve NIST? I mean, why not just farm it out directly to the it seemed odd. It just seemed odd to me because I thought if NIST is supposed to have all this technical expertise and be, you know, the world's expert on all these things, why are they farming it out to all these contractors? That's the best answer I can give, is that I'm sort of like puzzled by it, but there may be very good reasons for why so much of it was contracted out. But I don't know, I have no idea what conversations went on that made those decisions. All I can say is it did catch my eye that there were an awful lot of contractors.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for your courage.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
And then again, there could have been some very bad reasons why so many contractors were employed, but we'll end the session there, I believe. So thank you, Peter, for sharing what you have and for enlightening us on your background and for answering our questions.
Yep, you're welcome.
And we look forward to your continued participation in the teleconference. I know you've been here on several of them, and you're always welcome back, okay?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. So now we move on to our next item, which is the Museum of Conspiracy. And Cheryl will give us a lowdown on why we've invited Ryan Hess to be part of this conversation. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Yeah, in our agenda for last month's call, we had in there that I was going to talk about a possible 9/11 or Deep State Museum. And when Barbara Honegger saw that, she had somehow gotten wind of Ryan Hess, our guest, and that he has a website about a museum of conspiracy that he's planning on having actually in New York City, a physical building, I guess. We're going to find that out today, in 2019. So we invited him to be on this call to tell us, you know, about what he's done and his efforts and maybe help us figure out our direction. So so Ryan is the founder and the director of the Museum of Conspiracy. And welcome, Ryan, and we can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me. Well, I don't know where to get started. I guess I'll just jump right in. As you heard, my name is Ryan Hess. I went to school for history, political science, and just kind of got into conspiracies maybe when I was 19 or so, and just kind of never looked back, started looking into things and felt disconnected. Not very many of my friends believed in conspiracy theories. So one of my theses was on Freemasonry, the secret society of Freemasonry. And I just kind of felt as if there was a disconnect between people that thought critically and researched into conspiracies and thought for themselves. And they were kind of looked as a pariah, as outcast. And I just, it hurt my social life, if you will. I didn't want to have in-depth conversations with people because they would look at me funny. And so I just kind of always had it in the back of my mind that my lifelong goal would be to somehow change this stigma. And over the years, I've looked at reports and just kind of continued to see that there's been a changing upward trend of more and more people are becoming open to conspiracies. There's several different studies and numbers out there. Anywhere from 50 to 75% I've seen of Americans that believe in at least one conspiracy theory. And so the last year and a half, I've pretty much been working full time on basically a museum. I thought that there was something that was lacking. I know that there was once a museum in Dallas, which primarily focused on the JFK assassination. I'm not so sure if any of you are familiar or if I've ever been, but there once was, and I believe in 2006 it closed down due to real estate issues. I spoke with Barbara about that a little bit, and I know that you guys just recently had last month a call about possibly having an office, a museum, or some exhibits talking about 9/11, and it kind of falls in line with what my goal is. And I think what I've seen in the conspiracy theory world is that everybody has their opinion. There isn't just one 9/11 conspiracy. There's several different, I don't know if you guys have seen this personally, but just in my research, I've seen that there's, you know, there's this theory, there's that theory. And sometimes it's difficult for everybody that believes that 9/11 had some sort of fishiness to it. It's somewhat hard to get everybody to agree and to get on the same page. And so I came up with the idea, in which I'm, you know, fully developed and been working on, of having it somewhat in an unbiased museum. And what I mean by that is I fully intend for and hope to have a successful, educationally curated 9/11 exhibit. I guess a better example would be for me to talk to you about my plans of, well, let's say, the JFK, just for simple and time's sake. Those of you who are, I'm assuming, are familiar with the JFK assassination, there's, you know, the question of, was it a single shooter? And so in the exhibit, my plan or my idea was that there would be the official story. Visitors would come in, they would see what this official story is, and then there would be a replica rifle where visitors could kind of attempt to shoot the rifle and the amount of time, and they would most likely realize that there's really no way that they could shoot two shots from the same rifle in the allotted time, and therefore they would then explore theory one, theory two, theory three, and then at the end of it just kind of be asked, well, what did you think? Do you think that there's some merit to this conspiracy? because as I've seen, at least especially kids nowadays, they don't really like to be told what to do. And I think the best way to enact some sort of change, to create positive changes, to kind of get people to think for themselves. And I thought by not telling them what to think, by giving them alternatives in a credible physical space, there would be a way for people to explore where they wouldn't normally get to explore, except for on websites that probably they would question their validity and their educational content. And so that's kind of been my plan. I've created some preliminary renderings, have business plan financials, looked at real estate, formed the business in a couple of states, looked into all kinds of requirements. And I'm at the point now where I am now, this is kind of how I've become on this call, is I'm now going through the process of really bolstering just my outreach. Is I wanted to make sure I had everything in a row before kind of taking it more so public. So I connected with Barbara and had a call with her last month and was invited to come on here. So I'm attempting to get, I guess, more networking and expert opinions and speaking with those of you who have been active for so long, and take that into my investing rounds where investors can see the merit in how telling the truth and speaking of these things that we just heard, and how these odd curiosities will not only be good for, you know, the social world, but also for, you know, as they would like to say, their pocket. And so, that's basically where I'm at. I'm happy to elaborate on anything that you guys feel that you'd like to know. Shoot away.
Okay, let's go into question and answer mode here. And we have to unmute Ryan so he can respond. Okay, so let's see. Does anybody have a question or a comment? Star 6, if you'd like to be in the queue to make a comment or ask a question of Ryan. Okay, so our first, the next one is Barbara Heiniger. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. I didn't used to be able to press star 6 and be heard, but I have a new cell phone, so yay, it works. Okay, hi, Ryan. How are you? It's Barbara. Okay.
Hi, I'm great. I'm great.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment here. First, I want to know, were you today on the USS Intrepid or not? That's my first question. I thought you might be talking with the chief of staff there, and if you could tell us about your possible venues, including this amazing idea like the USS Intrepid Museum on the Hudson River, actually being on some kind of a converted barge for your museum. So that's question number one, but my comment, I really like, it's a freeing idea to have a museum that includes 9/11 facts. You don't have to say 9/11 truth. That's presumptive. I like your idea of bringing people in, showing them the official story, which I do in the 9/11 Museum virtual walking tour, and then take it apart. But I love the idea of coming in, showing people the official story, and then giving them facts, and then giving them the different interpretation of those facts and let them decide for themselves. I love it. It's a freeing idea, especially regarding the Pentagon attack, which is, you know, still controversial within our movement. So thanks.
Thank you for the comments. That's really nice to hear. And as far as your question, I have not met with that individual yet. I have a meeting scheduled on Friday, what she's referring to for those. I was reached out to by one of the chiefs of staff at the Intrepid Museum that just thought it was a really amazing idea and wanted to lend a hand. Has kind of worked in the museum industry for several years. And so I'm meeting with for drinks and a couple of days to kind of discuss her possible involvement to see what we can accomplish, what value could be added, and where we could kind of take that. And then as far as locations, I've been continuing to look at the best viable options almost weekly. Well, this week I actually looked at several times at spaces to rent, spaces to buy, so that I know the answer for both of those when it comes to the time where the specific location needs to be picked. I do think that that needs to be in Manhattan, and the reason for that is just because it will reach as many people as we could. And mainly, the answer is it could be anywhere that basically has good walking traffic as well as metro accessibility. We once explored the possibility of putting it on a barge to avoid real estate issues, because the Conspiracy Museum in Dallas actually closed down because the landlord did not renew the lease. And so in my viability study, that was one of my major challenges and concerns, was making sure that real estate was not an issue. So I kind of explored, if I put the museum on a barge and fabricated it, I could simply move it. But in terms of upfront costs, it was quite extensive, and so it's more of potentially a long-term or expansion idea at this point that will have to be explored going forward.
Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Oh yeah. Could you give us some idea with the analysis, the cost analysis comparisons you've done? Wouldn't the barge idea be more comparable to the cost of buying a property or building instead of renting? I mean, renting would be the most cost-effective, but it's also a problem in terms of being shut down if you're considered controversial. So if you could tell us about that trade-off, if you've investigated it cost-wise?
Yes. So I will start with the renting. The renting is obviously the cheapest cost up front. The what it's looking like is in a, let's say, a 10,000 square foot building, you're looking at potentially $90 to $100 per square foot per year. So you're looking at roughly $1 million a year to lease, to lease a space. To purchase a space, I saw some spaces that could potentially work at 14-ish million, which I believe, I'm not an expert in commercial real estate, but I actually have a meeting as well this week with somebody that kind of is, and typically 30 to 35% of a down payment is required. So
wow.
Once again, the upfront costs are quite substantial. And then in terms of the barge...
Was that Larry Silverman you met with, by any chance?
No, it was not.
Yeah, he's got the money.
My last question,
Ryan, are you... So I understand you're in New York City right now.
Yeah, actually, I landed at about 5 p.m., and with New York Transit, I got into the place where I'm staying at about 7-something. So,
good
yes,
luck, and can you give us an update maybe next month on the last Wednesday of the month? We'd love to have an update.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. Thank you, Barbara. Our next questioner is Carl Golovin.
Carl Golovin. Hi,
welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Thank you. Ryan, hi, thanks. Thank you also for your interest in the JFK assassination. That will be partly relevant to what I'm discussing later. But as far as a 9/11 museum, if I could focus here on Washington, D.C. for a moment, it's the ultimate venue for impressionable young people to be brought through on a constant basis. High school kids are brought to D.C., and there's a building called the Newseum, N-E-W-S-E-U-M. And it's like they have the official mainstream media story of everything there. They have a 9/11 exhibit that scrupulously avoids any of the controversial questions, nothing about World Trade Center 7. Actually, that's something I intend to do, is write a letter. I'm a member of a modest donor level, that they could be compelled to add a World Trade Center 7 segment, perhaps, at the museum. But in Washington, Ford's Theater, the epicenter of Lincoln's assassination, Just a few blocks from there is the building that was the boarding house where the acknowledged conspirators all met and hatched the plot. And that's currently, the ground floor at least, is a Chinese restaurant. It's almost like everyone wants to avoid realizing what it is and have it made a national historical landmark and made into a museum. But we can talk offline if you need the address. That would be the optimal like initial starting point because it's just a block or two from Ford's Theater, and you could probably get those groups of high school kids who all go through Ford's Theater. And there is a greater truth to the Lincoln assassination than is allowed to circulate in the mainstream. And that would be a great conspiracy museum starting point. Probably.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's communicate offline, I guess, would be simplest.
Yeah, I'd love to. You can, if you go to Museum of Conspiracy for anybody that ever, museumofconspiracy.com, at the very bottom there's a contact form. I could give you my email or somebody could pass it along, but if you don't want to write that down or forget, to museumofconspiracy.com, there's a contact form and I'll just email it to me. I'd be happy to discuss it. And that's actually a really great point. Just to kind of elaborate real quick on that, there's an international spy museum. I don't know if you're familiar, but it's also a for-profit museum. And it's really close to there. And you touched on a really great point of touching the young kids so that they can kind of go through on all those field trips. And that's something I did. I grew up in Virginia. I went to all the Smithsonian museums in middle school. So remember that, and I think many people believe that any museum in D.C. is kind of a part of a government museum, and so it would be really moving and telling to have something there where kids are going through. So I think it's a brilliant idea. I'd love to talk with you and chat with you more about that offline.
Well, it's just remarkable that this particular building hasn't been demolished. It's still there. So, okay.
Hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah, maybe you should follow up next time on the results of that for the discussion. Okay, so we'll go to Wayne Costi. Wayne?
Yeah, Ryan, thank you so much. It's a fascinating thing. I've got kind of two kind of related questions. I guess it's really one. What are you doing for outreach to promote the museum? I've heard about the Facebook page and the website. Are you trying to keep it quiet or you want a vibrant outreach? What are your thoughts on that? I'll also, this is kind of an unrelated comment, but it's, the USS Maine had a problem. And so I was wondering how a barge might fare if it's really something that is controversial. So, but how are you trying to promote this? And that's all. Thanks. Over.
Yeah. So I'll real quick, the short of it is I actually ran a Kickstarter back in, I want to say October. I now see that it was a huge mistake. I did get published in a website or two talking about the story, talking about the project. And I did a conspiracy wall where I walked the streets of New York City with a 4x6 rolling chalkboard. Basically, the common law partner is a PR expert. So she helped me. She walked around, and we carried this large 4x6 moving rolling chalkboard through Washington Square Park, through Union Square, through Brooklyn and the streets, and people would write which conspiracies they believed. We just invited anybody, and we would get crowds of like 1,000 people. Park patrol were having to come in and make sure that we kept ushering people closer so that they didn't block any exits and people could walk through the park. So it was a fantastic reception of the project and of the idea. We handed out postcards trying to get people to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And within a week, we got 1,000 people to follow and like us on Facebook. But since then, the Kickstarter failed. Long story short, there was a naming mishap, so I needed to change the name to avoid a PR nightmare with some German artist. And since then, I never really wanted to go the Kickstarter route, but I thought it was a good way to kind of get the name and word out there. It worked really quickly, but since then I've kind of used and taken what I've learned from people And now I'm actually really attempting to come on Twitter. And the reason for that is I have a list of potential investors, mainly athletes, celebrities, that have spoken publicly about particular conspiracy theories. And I thought that it would be the best way to have the fewest number of people that wanted their opinion was to try to reach those individuals directly. So within the last month, I went from like 5 Twitter followers to 250. And so it's been rapidly growing, but I am hoping to get that as massive of an outreach as I possibly can in the next couple of months, so that it kind of provides some sort of credibility when it comes to reaching out to these investors and trying to get partners along the road. So, I'm doing what I can mainly on Twitter, and a somewhat kind of let Facebook and Instagram fall by the wayside, which I think might be a little bit of a flaw of mine now that you mention it. So I'm open to hearing your guys' advice and what you guys think I can and should do. The reason why I'm on the call, honestly, is because I feel the most important thing in my discussion with Barbara, the most important thing is to have this be a museum, not just for, and honestly, I have no care about anything but the objective. I really just want to make my mark on the world. And I think the people like you that have been so outspoken and proponents of this movement, I think it's really important to have you all on my side and to somewhat be partners along the way. And so, please, I'm happy, whether it's offline now or somewhere down the road, I'm open and would love to hear all of your suggestions.
Okay, thank you for that. I need to make a quick announcement here. As often happens, we're starting to run into a time crunch here. We have 2 more people on stack to ask questions, and we'll give them an opportunity, but ask them to be concise. I also want to mention for the record that Barry Zwicker, Lynn Bradley, Xander Arena, and Lawrence Fine have all joined the call, I think, since we took the role. So, Xander, please be brief, and here's your opportunity to make your question.
I have a comment. The 6th Floor Museum in Dallas is still alive and well. My wife and I visited it in 2011, and my mother was recently asked to be a board member of it. There was a very interesting vetting process for that, which I can talk to you about at some point if you're interested. She's on the other side of our fight. At any rate, I would like to be involved in this museum. You're going to get a lot of pushback from establishment folks. I, too, grew up in the D.C. area. I'm familiar with all the museums you've spoken of, and I think I've got a lot of good insight for you. So I'm going to be following up with you via email. And the other thing I want to encourage you to do is utilize the phone when you talk to people, because it's easy for digital messages to be archived, erased, spammed, et cetera. And you may not hear from the people that you need to talk to. So pick up the old phone, talk to us, and we'll get a good project done. Thanks, man.
Sounds good. I appreciate it. Look forward to it.
Yep.
Okay, great. And lastly, Lawrence Fine. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Hi, Ryan. This is Lorenzo, and I really appreciate what you're doing. I just wanted to get your contact info, but I can get you through the Museum of Conspiracy.com, so that's what I'll do. I'd like to share some material that I have with you.
Fantastic. I look forward to it.
Well, great. It's really been an enlightening conversation. Hopefully, we won't be dropping this matter anytime soon, and always want to ask our guests to return and give us updates, keep us informed of his progress with this project, and let's see what we can do. Okay. All right. We move on now to our next.
Well, what happened? Sorry. What is it? Chicken? Sorry.
Huh? Okay. So we move on.
No.
Yeah, if you have background noise, please press *6 so the rest of us don't need to hear it. Thank you. And the next item is the Pentagon Tree. Wayne Costi is going to give us his presentation on this. And we will take time afterwards for some very brief questions and answers, but they have to be kept very clear, very brief, because we're running up against the time limit here, and we have another item on the agenda. So, Wayne, it's all yours. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. So, first of all, thanks for having me on again. The presentation's the tree at column 16, what it tells us about the event of the Pentagon. A copy of it can be found on a website, www.hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. And so that's where I've archived many of my previous presentations here that talk about the physical evidence at the Pentagon. And let's move on here. Going on to slide number four, the tree at column 16 is a large identifiable object. As we all know, a movement of a large identifiable object is subject to the laws of physics. And what we see here, and I'll show you, we'll be going through the photos here, and I hope you all have downloaded the PowerPoint. The trunk has been severed a few feet off the ground. There are tree branches that are seen to the north of the impact area, up against the Pentagon building. You can see them in the fire. Photographs taken after the event document the presence of the lower tree trunk in front of the Pentagon wall and to the left where it's still undamaged. And the lower tree trunk was thrown over 100 feet northward. Large mass thrown northward. And this is evidence of that supports a large plane impact scenario. This particular issue of the tree has been it's never been brought to anyone's attention. I only ran across references to the tree stump once or twice in my work, so in my research. So this is slide four. Moving on to slide five, the displacement of the tree above the tree stump, the movement can't be explained, as near as I can tell, by the other theories. It's unexplainable by a cruise missile into the building. It's unexplainable by an exploding drone or other plane, although Barbara's going to say that there could be bombs everywhere. It's unexplainable by drop bombs. You can't do all the damage to the Pentagon building and all this stuff without doing a lot more damage elsewhere. It's unexplained by a north of Sitka flight path, because it would knock the tree into the wall and not a flight path from the south, which would knock the tree northward, which is where we find it. It's supportive of a large aircraft that was reported by most witnesses as approaching and impacting. Slide six is a picture of the Pentagon wall. It's a year or so before 9/11. It's got the old firehouse in front of it, and you can see that there's a tree in front of column 16, and then there's two other ones that are to the left of the old firehouse. We'll see those. They remain. We'll see those later. Slide seven is another photograph of that, and you can I've highlighted the tree in front of column 16, and you can also see the trailers in front of the building. Those are the things that will be burning in many of the photos that you see. Slide eight is before the section of the wall collapses, a section of the building collapses. And you can see the wide opening or parts of it, the south end of it. And so we're going to kind of zoom in on this later. Going on to slide nine, Michael Wilson, as many of you know, has done an analysis of the large plane impact scenario. And he doesn't even know what to do with this tree. If you look at slide nine, you see the plane's approaching. It hits it begins to approach the tree. It starts to push the tree down. It kind of goes down, and that's the last you ever see of it in this discussion or anywhere else. So he didn't know what to do with it, and he covered a lot of the different physical evidence that was there. Going on to slide 12, you can see that's where it's kind of the last step in his sequence there. Slide 13 is kind of the zoom in of the image that we had seen a little while ago. You can see the remnants of column 16 hanging from the second floor. The shattered tree stump is in this particular picture from Jason Ingersoll has now been covered with a fire retardant firefighting foam, and that's why it looks kind of all grayish over here. But you can see it there. We're going to see this tree stump a number of times in the upcoming photographs. Slide 14, you can see it in the post-collapse wall on 9/11 itself. slide 15 is a several days later, a different angle. You can see just how shattered it is. It's still there. So I'm going to go through a couple of slides that talk about the probable impact. Slides 17 shows a plane approaching about where I think it would have been. The tree is probably caught by the leading wing spar between the fuselage and the engine. That's consistent with the damage. Slide 18, you can see the tree starting to get knocked, had been severed. 19, it's still has momentum and is being dragged northward. And in 20, that's about where we find it. So that's the impact sequence. Slide 20, moving on to slide 22, the tree branches are seen along the north side of the impact area. These tree branches are at the north end. They were overlooked by 9/11 Pentagon analysts. The presence has been unexplained. I was actually concerned when it was raised by Barbara some months ago that they were might be rebar. I knew that they were there, didn't know where they came from, and so I had to go back and really figure out where they came from, and I was able to find all these photos and put the story together about what happened to that tree at column 16. Slide 23 is from the smoke curtain in which Barbara, I don't believe, is the only person that said this, but you know, but when you actually look at it, it is not rebar. Slide 24 is a cleaner, higher resolution version of that photo where you just saw. Slide 25 is a zoom in, and here you can see the branches tangled in the with the fire behind it. So that's a kind of a close up of those tree branches. So we've got the tree that used to be there. We show the tree branches here. Slide 26 is the tree branches after they've been after the fire's been put out and the wall and the section has collapsed. You can see that they're still there. Slide 27 is during another one just after the firefighting. You can see the tree branches are still, you know, where they are. Slide 28, you can see them again, same place, in kind of the orientation that we saw in the first image of the sequence. Slide 29, you can see them again. Again, these are all done, many of the photos are taken with telephoto lenses, and so the perspective is kind of hard to see. You can see in slide 29, you can see the tree branches extending, visibly extending out to about slide 20, about column 5. So zooming into some of the other pictures of the tree stump, we have slide 31, Jason Ingersoll photo, and what we see here is the tree stump is kind of highlighted in a yellow square box. Slide 32 kind of zooms in, and you can see the trunk. You can see one of the branches. You can see several of the branches emanating from there. Slide 33. These were taken during the cleanup. You can see the tree stumps in this on slide 33 has been limbed and is in front of the where column 9AA is, and so you can see it there. Slide 34. You can see it. I zoomed in so you can see it a little clearer. I mean, these aren't great photos, but it certainly is there. And slide 35 is yet another photo of the limbed tree at that location. So going on to talking about some debris that's on the Pentagon lawn that has not received much discussion either. People have argued that the debris has been planted, but amongst all this debris, and here slide 37 shows some of it, you can see tree vegetation that is amongst all this. That would have been the hypothesis, of course, is that it would have been dispersed by the very large fireball. Slide 38 is showing the the large piece of wreckage. And in the background, you see yet another large piece of vegetation from that probably wasn't there before whatever the event was. So some large event carried that debris up and northward, and it appears to have been the trailing air mass behind a plane hitting and impacting and having no place to go, and it goes up and over, creating, and that's what dragged the fireball so wide and so high. So that was slide 38. Slide 39 is another picture that shows a lot of the vegetation. And I'll point out here that if you look to the left of the fire truck, you can see one of the trees that was to the left still visible. You can also, in this image, it's hard to make out in this particular slide here, but you can see the other tree to the right of the fire truck. So all the trees on the face are accounted for. And I believe that's my last slide. So now I'm ready for questions, and I think I did my 15 minutes good justice here.
Yes, you did, Wayne, and thank you for your excellent time management. So we'll now go into Q&A mode. Please keep your questions or comments very brief because we have another item on the agenda that we need to take care of yet. So who would like to star six if you'd like to be to make a comment or ask a question? First is Barbara Honecker. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, Barbara.
Oh, okay. There's voices in the background. I just wondered. Okay. Well, as long as you can hear me, that's fine. I just want everybody to know that I've done a detailed rebuttal of what Wayne's just presented, and I sent it to everyone on the 9/11 teleconference list. I know we're short on time. Please go there. It's very detailed, supported. The first thing I want to just say is, first, Wayne, you don't have to put down another person. I think that is really beyond the pale when you say that Will Barber will say there were bombs all over the place. You know that isn't true. In my rebuttal, I'm very specific on the specific explosions that cannot be explained by the official story, which basically you support, official story light. So everybody just needs to go there and see for yourself why Wayne is making a lot of unfounded assumptions here. Thank you.
Anybody that's not on our listserv that would like access to it, please send me your name and your request with your email address, and we'll get you on our listserv, and you can access this kind of information. Okay, next would be Xander Irvin. Go ahead, Xander.
Hey, Wayne. I guess Barbara's kind of touched on it, but I think it's plausible that the tree was damaged by explosions from within that aspect of the building, and that would explain why the tree didn't end up in the middle of the building. And I also, if you rewind your own audio, I think you'll hear you say the tree was dragged northward, and I think that's probably exactly what happened. It was blown outwards, landed somewhere in front of the building, and then was placed in a northern area of the lawn. But that's my only comment. I do look forward to looking at everybody's slides, yours and hers and all the rest of it, and I appreciate your input. Thanks. Bye.
Oops, I just realized that Wayne is probably muted. I apologize for that, Wayne. So if you'd like to comment, go ahead. If you want to comment to Wayne, to Barbara, or Xander, go ahead.
Yeah, so let me just respond to Xander first. So the possibility of this tree having been blown out and then dragged is, you know, I cut trees and for firewood, and to move a tree is not something that can be done without a huge amount of equipment. And there were photographs of the building within minutes, the Daryl Donnelly photos. And in fact, Barbara references in her letter, her email, how the Daryl Donnelly image number 14 could have been, was the thing that blew the tree outward or destroyed it. But that photo's number one from Daryl Donnelly. The first one doesn't show a tree there. So the tree is gone as soon as he starts taking pictures in the first 3 minutes. So trying to put all connect all the dots, the only thing that makes sense, and, you know, I'm not going to convince you folks here on the conference call if you're not going to look at the only explanation is a large momentum impact to the tree that severs the tree from the stump in the lower trunk, and it gets kicked to the kicked or dragged or whatever you want to describe the tree moving 100 feet to the north, you know. But that's what the evidence shows, and you know, I mean that's what the physics would have to be. You know, we don't have photos of the whole thing happening, as you know, but this is a piece that has not been explored before, and I was able to come up with this, and I haven't seen anyone else address this particular piece. And it can only be explained, as I can see it, by a large momentum impact, unless you have a very carefully orchestrated, lots of explosives to move all sorts of stuff. And, you know, if that's where we're at, that's where we're at. But,
yeah. Wayne, did you want to comment on Barbara's comment?
Well, I think I did. So
yeah,
you know.
Fair enough. Okay, no problem. Okay, well, thank you. All that pretty much takes care of that part of our agenda. And Wayne, thank you.
Ken, sorry, it's Craig. I can't use the feature when I'm one of the hosts. So
go ahead, Craig.
I'll make it quick. I obviously I don't agree with Wayne, so I won't get into my thinking on that. But I did have a couple of questions, of quick ones. One is, what part of the plane do you think, Wayne, that actually would have hit this tree? Because it appears to be it appears to be severed quite low, and it also appears to be kind of in behind, at least in one of the photographs, in behind the large spools. So I'm wondering what is supposed to have hit the tree, whether it's the right engine, and if that's the case, how could it even survive that impact and not just get pulled into the building if you're alleging an impact? That's one photo. The other one is just very simple. How are we certain of what trees were actually in place on the 11th of September, and whether could there have been an additional tree that isn't in the photographs that you showed that maybe was added later? I'm just not aware of that one way or the other myself. So that's my two questions.
Okay, so the as we've discussed in other emails, the aerial photographs of the satellite photos of the Pentagon on September 7th show what appears to be a single tree at about the column 16 area. So that's September 7th. And again,
okay,
it's a satellite. It's not a particularly good photo, but that is strongly indicative that there is something there that 4 days before September 11th. Do we know that it wasn't moved on the 8th, 9th, or 10th? No, we don't. But again, the tree, there had been a tree there, and we find a tree laying along the north or along the west side of the Pentagon. We see the branches during the fire. We see the trunk. We see the trunk being cut up. It looks like a tree. You know, it just seems that that's how what happened to the tree. So you asked, how did it get hit? I tried to, with my best graphics capability, which isn't very good, show on slide on the series slide 17, 18, 19, and 20, I guess, where I think it hit. It looks to me, based on the engine having been to just to the left of column 18, which was not destroyed, column 17 was, and the other engine probably going in around column 10, that would be right next to the fuselage and the leading wing spar, where the front leading wing spar is the strongest. It's got to hold up all the weight of the plane, and so it's a really strong strong mechanical object. If this is coming in at a high rate of speed, 400 or 500 miles an hour, it is going to hit it, slice it, sever it, and then as and it's coming in at a 38 degree from the south angle to the wall. So it's more than a 45. It's more coming north than it is going into the building, and that is going to give it a lot of northward momentum. And it can't. And so I think I've answered your question. I'll take a clarifying question if you like. Over.
Well, okay. So you say it, northward, but it's on the south side of the plane where this impact would be taking place. So how does the tree get from the right side of the plane over 100 feet to the left of where the plane would have entered? What caused that to happen?
Well, first of all, the plane's moving in is probably one of the, you know, as the plane would have hit, it would have given some momentum, and then the plane's moving and being destroyed as it's being destroyed as it's impacting the wall and pushing through and all that other stuff disappearing inside. So the actual mechanics of how it would be impacted, severed, what kind of damage it would do to the plane that's impacting the wall is probably another area of study. I'm not sure I'm going to get into it because the tree being where it started, showing the shattered stump. It's not a nice cut stump like they came out with a chainsaw the day before. So the stump's been shattered, and the lower half, the lower trunk, is moved far to the north, and it's coming up again with the 38 degree angle to the wall, according to the flight path. So,
would you, if I can just finish this last point? I know I've taken too long, but I mean, we know that there were explosions inside of Wedge 2 near the heliport. That propelled stuff out, including branches from the very large tree or trees that were near the heliport. Why couldn't some of the branches that you're pointing to be from that tree?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that there's external explosions to anything north of about column 8.
Not external. I didn't say external.
Well,
internal.
Then you don't see anything being blown out because the windows may be damaged, but because they weren't the reinforced windows in Wedge 2, but the reinforced ones were only in Wedge 1 that had been renovated with blast resistant windows. But there are many reports of explosions, and Barbara talks about them being throughout and also in the rings A and B. But I'm really not aware of anything that would be doing the damage that you're hypothesizing on those walls. Again, those trees are pretty much intact, although they're badly burned at the end of the day. Over.
Okay. I think we have to leave it for now. Thank you, Craig. And now, thank you again, Wayne, for your presentation. And now let's move on to our last item on the agenda, which would be our report from James Hufford on a very interesting book, We Will Not Be Silenced. James, the floor is yours. Whoops, I think we have to get our Q&A mode first. Sorry, James, go ahead.
Okay. This book that I'm going to review is entitled We Will Not Be Silenced, The Academic Repression of Israel's Critics, published by AK Press, Chico, California, 2017, William I. Robinson and Miriam S. Griffin editors. It's 222... Let's see, some odd plus 222 pages. It consists of 14 essays from apparently a sampling of serious repression It's forwarded by Cynthia McKinney, who has relevant experience herself. And this review is going to be kind of general and impressionistic, and because I'm not necessarily the obvious person to do the review, and you may know better than I from personal experience about this subject, but I may just say to preface it that I was terminated from teaching at three campuses of a college in 2009 and 10 for my 9/11 activism, my 9/11 truth activism, so I know a little bit about what that feels like. Reading this book, I was astonished at the sheer size and power of the Israeli Zionist establishment of ostensibly NGOs in the U.S., but also by the organized strength of the Justice for Palestine pushback. The modus operandi of the Israel on Campus Coalition, Anti-Defamation League, etc., seems to be the following. First of all, they would not argue any of it. If they debated, they wouldn't argue any of the points made, but they'd simply reiterate their propaganda points over and over. they would attack through threats to withhold funding. That was probably their most potent weapon, getting a hold of the college's administration and usually the philanthropists that kept the school afloat, getting off, and they were Zionists themselves, and they would get them to demand the firing or non-withholding of tenure of alleged miscreants. They would distort or falsify their writings, sometimes make them up out of whole cloth, anecdotes, credentials, and so forth. And they would treat efforts to explain, to simply explain Palestinian actions as condoning or encouraging rather than just simply trying to understand, and attack any faculty member or advanced student with a Middle Eastern sounding name or background, assuming bias that was often unproven, and they would come up with all sorts of assumed writings that they had done or mischaracterize them, misquote them, one thing or another like that. And if they'd ever favored Palestinians or were critical of Israeli actions, they would hold that American students shouldn't be exposed or subjected to such poppycock as that. Jewish faculty members were often attacked as well, called self-hating Jews, if they even suggested fairness for Palestinians. One prominent example in the book was Lisa Rafael, distinguished professor of anthropology at UC Santa Cruz, who attempted to organize, at least socially, pro-justice for Palestinian Jewish faculty members, and compiled a list of some 2,000. Her field wasn't even Middle Eastern studies, but women's studies, but that didn't exempt her from being attacked. she wouldn't have necessarily talked a lot about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in her classes, but that didn't really seem to matter. freedom of speech in the First Amendment obviously means nothing when it comes to Israel, and I think we should take note of that. If you ever speak out prominently, you're going to be attacked. I know personally that it's a very sore subject because just simply requiring, trying to require evidence before people concluded Israeli actual on-hands involvement in 9/11 subjected me to being called an Israeli stooge and all that stuff, which is just ludicrous. but anyway, as another extreme example, Stephen Salado, who is a Palestinian Jordanian U.S. born professor of American Indian Studies, first of all at Virginia Tech, and then he got hired by University of Illinois Champaign Urbana, and 2 weeks before he was to start his job there, he received a letter from the chancellor of the university telling him that he need not show up because there had been complaints against him just from based on some tweets that he'd made criticizing Israeli treatment of Palestinians. So basically that's my review. Has anybody else acquired this book?
Has anybody else read the book?
I have not, but I certainly am going to get it now. Thank you for letting me know
about
it.
Yeah, it's a good resource.
That was a very, very challenging interview. Review, and thank you for it. Does anybody want to make a comment or a question? Ask a question. We'll go into Q&A more briefly. If anybody wants to make a comment or ask a question of James regarding his review of this fascinating book, one that's certainly up
on
alley.
I have a quick comment. I don't know if there are other people
ahead
of me.
Nobody's on the stack, so go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everybody that one of the people that we had invited to come on the call when we had our the call that focused on this particular issue, particularly with when we had Kevin Barrett on and Tony Hall and Jeremy Roth Cashel back, I think it was November, we had invited William Robinson, but I actually ended up hearing from him after the call. He had not been seeing his emails or whatever. So he's the, I guess, the editor of this book that James just talked about. So I just want to remind people of that, that if we ever did want to have him on the call, that it probably, you know, it would be possible if we gave him enough advance notice. So if that interested anybody, that would be a possibility.
Is it correct, James? Is he the editor?
He's a co-editor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a co-editor, along with Miriam Griffin.
And this is Cheryl. I can't do the star six either. It doesn't work for me. But I did just want to say, again, thank you for presenting this. I'll definitely get a copy. And I'm just really thrilled that somebody wrote a book like this or did, you know, edited this book. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's really well done.
Yeah, it certainly meets the need that we have certainly identified on this call for dealing with the repression both on and off the campus from these usual suspects. Okay, Xander Arena would like to make a comment or ask a question. Go ahead, Xander.
Yeah, hey, James. Excellent review. Thanks for it. I guess I just have a comment. You know, it's such a touchy subject. I know within my own family, my stepmother's Jewish and my half-sister is, and, you know, anytime I bring up 9/11 and it's very easy for folks to say, oh, you're an anti-Semite or this, that, or the other thing. And so just a comment for everybody on the call. It's important to be able to point those arguments to people like Steve Pichenik, who come from Jewish heritage, who were some of the first vocal 9/11 truthers. I don't know if you guys know who Steve Pichenik is, but you can find him online. And you know, it's just one of those things. We have to not conflate the religion and the culture with the government. And so just stand your ground, and facts are facts, and the chips will fall where they may. Obviously, there had to be some complicity here at home, so it's not like it's one group's fault. Anyways, that's my comment. Thanks for your review.
Thank you.
Okay, and Barbara.
Yeah, hi, just really quick. It's Barbara. I wasn't going to come on to make a comment or ask a question until I just heard that last comment. And I want to really, really back it up. A very interesting statistic that I read, if anyone's interested, I'll try to find it. God knows where it is now. But it's in a book, and a very credible book. And it states that based upon statistical analysis of some kind, polling, that approximately half of all Zionists are Jews, but half aren't. And I think it's very important not to say Jews, but to say radical Zionist terrorists. You know, yeah. I mean, we have to, it's not just the government, because one of our goals, I think, is to change the radical Likudist Zionist religious-backed government in Israel. I think that would solve a lot of the world's problems. So I just wanted to back up the comment that was just made.
Okay, thanks, Barbara.
Great.
I think that concludes this part of our agenda. So now we will go on to announcements, and we have reserved the first announcement for our newest member, Carl Golovin, who has a special announcement that may take a little time, but we think it'll be worth your while to hear what he has to say. So go ahead, Carl, and then if anybody else would like to go ahead afterwards, we'll reserve time for you too. Go ahead, Carl.
Ken, thank you. I'll give a brief introduction. I'm a retired special agent of U.S. Customs, spent most of my career in South Florida as a criminal investigator. August 2001, I was reassigned to the Office of Internal Affairs field office in Virginia, which is where I was working on 9/11. I volunteered and was sent up on a detail for 3 weeks in November of 2000. Half that 3 weeks was spent at Ground Zero, babysitting the rubble of number 6, or the remains of number 6, Customs House. Every other day was at Fresh Kills Landfill, where we were tasked with sifting the rubble of number 7, which was brought over by truck. We're told agencies in the building didn't want any of their computer components left in the landfill. Interesting perspective. Whether those are demolition electronics that there might have been concern would have been left in rubble is an interesting departure point for new investigation. But in any event, I have long had an interest in the Kennedy assassination. My father actually worked for the Kennedy White House as a science and peace advisor.
Excuse me, Carl, you're breaking up really badly. Could you try... standing closer to the mic?
I'll go off speakerphone. Is this better?
Thank you. Yes, it is. It's much better. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that. I was trying speakerphone. So if everyone's looking at their agenda, there's a space to click on here next to the image of the book, We Will Not Stand or Not Be Silenced. Or I can give you a domain name. The domain is www.com. An idea lives on. I'll repeat that. An idea lives on. That's forwarded to an op-ed news article that basically what I've tried to do is look at the broadest perspective from JFK to 9/11, Operation Gladio, Operation Northwoods in between, and explain the context of false flag terrorism, which is evident pervasively from JFK to 9/11. And actually, because we're coming up on a real focal point in history concerning JFK, almost more so than it's an opportunity to bring together younger people who are familiar with 9/11 and cause them to understand there's a resonance here. And about 3.5 years ago, it dawned on me that, you know, we're almost trapped into trying. Is someone, actually, people could mute if they're not speaking. There's some background noise I'm hearing.
Star 6 to mute if you're having background noise. Go ahead.
Okay. So I've realized that, as with JFK, and even in this phone call, we all get sidetracked into trying to discuss or debate the minutiae of how it was done, what happened. And in reality, if the general population can just be awakened to the idea or the obvious fact that false flag terrorism is used to perpetuate the consolidation of power and use what the Constitution says, peaceably assemble, and just in large numbers, you know, not a million-man march, but a million-person peaceable assembly. It's interesting, neither protest nor demonstration, neither of those words is in the Constitution. Peaceably assemble and petition are the standard for accomplishing something. And May 29th is John Kennedy's 100th birthday, or 100th anniversary of his birth. And in Washington, D.C., the Kennedy Center, I've stumbled on this as a focal point, really, for the records, JFK records issue about 3.5 years ago, realizing, you know, it's almost demonic how thousands of people a day will go to the Kennedy Center to be entertained in America's living memorial to John Kennedy, while in the meantime, the records of his murder are kept secret. And as we move forward, first May 29th, his 100th anniversary of his birth, November 22nd, which is right after the ultimate required by statute release day for the Kennedy assassination records, it provides a focal point where millions of people who are not, or thousands at least, who haven't studied either of these issues in detail could be persuaded that, yeah, this is just not right, and to come out. And so I'll give you another, if you can go to that article at anidealivson.net, and it's an op-ed news article that explains the concept of peaceably assembling on the public terraces of the Kennedy Center just a month from now on May 29th at noon. And really there's a convergence of events because at 4 o'clock, just a few hours later that day, there is the Kennedy Center's official centennial celebration. And there are actually probably 1,000 tickets still available. It's in the Opera House. And in the next few days, actually, Wayne, we discussed, I think he's planning to repost my article in the TAP newsletter. If we can inspire people to go online and spend $25 to buy one of those tickets to the Kennedy Center's celebration of John Kennedy's life, and just meet 3 hours, 4 hours before on the North Public Terrace. And I have an emblem actually as a magnet-backed button one can wear on their lapel or their shirt. It's a fairly elegant design. You'll see it in the article, just commemorating the 100th anniversary of Kennedy's birth. And just peaceably assemble without speeches, without signs. I found that doing this every 6 months for the last couple of years, signs tend to devolve into peculiar signs that really distract or reduce credibility, and speeches, they can be a distraction as well. Just the idea, if people will just get together and talk with each other and commit to coming back if necessary, if the records aren't released in November 22nd, and bring a dozen friends each, it will create a presence. And once having peaceably assembled, there's no statute, no regulation requiring a permit that can prevent you from peaceably dispersing and reassembling elsewhere, as in front of the White House, et cetera. And if enough people peaceably assemble on the public terraces of the Kennedy Center, it's just creating an opportunity for something to happen that maybe isn't fully known, but I think it would be constitutional. And as long as it's peaceable, I think it will be noticeable and effective. So anidealivson.net and actually jfkvigil.com are that's forwarded directly to an Eventbrite link, which I hope all of you will consider signing up there just to have your email address in the network for the future announcements. That's about
it. Okay. Thank you. We'll make sure to have those links in the minutes. Then Any other announcements?
Yes, I want to announce about our Left Forum panels that we're doing. Kat McGuire and I are doing 6 panels again this year at the Left Forum. We have 5 this year. We did 6 last year.
Yeah, this is Cheryl speaking, by the way. Cheryl Curtis. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, yeah, sorry. And so the 5 panels we have, one is 9/11 Truth. It's just the basic 9/11, and it's, we call it Ground Zero for a Resistance Movement. And we have Kevin Barrett and Barbara Honegger and Richard Gage will be on that one. And we figure a lot of the people at the Left Forum don't know anything about it at all, so we want to do the basics. Then we have one on false flags, staged, scripted mass PSYOP events with Kevin Barrett and David Lindorf and Ole Demigard from Norway. And then we have political correctness, the dangers of thought crime police, and this relates to what James was just saying. We have Anthony Hall, Joy Carrigo, who lost her job at Oberlin, for I think she was maybe tweeting something in support of Palestinians, and then Jeremy Roth Cushell, who has been on our call here also. So those 3 will be talking about their experiences. And then we have one, Co-opting the Left, Infiltration by the Corporate State to Neutralize Resistance. And for that we have Kevin Zeist and Margaret Flowers, both of the Popular Resistance is their website. And then from Black Agenda Report, we have Glenn Ford, and he's one of their keynote speakers. So they've approved of that panel already. They like that one, but we haven't heard anything about the other ones yet. And then the last one is Terrorism, Fake Enemies, Fraudulent Wars, and we have Michael Springman, Anthony Hall, and Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire on that one. So, and we have had complaints. That there's a guy in New York named Spencer Sunshine who wrote to the Left Forum and said he had a whole group of New Yorkers with him, and he didn't provide anybody's names. And he said that he didn't think we should be allowed to present this year, and he was particularly against Kevin Baer. He said we were all far right wingers and that we were anti-Semitic and, you know, the same old thing. So, and he didn't like Kevin Barrett, and they didn't want Anthony Hall. And then there was another guy in Canada who wrote and complained, and his name is Kai something, I forget his last name, but Kevin Barrett said that he's been harassing him and Anthony Hall for a long time, and he goes by pseudonyms, and he's some kind of a, sounds like a nutcase. But anyway, so those are the 2 complaints they got, and I don't know what they're going to do with us. So, you know, we've explained to them that that's not who we are, and they were, actually they handled it well. They let us respond to the complaints with our own letters, and they sent it to the Spencer Sunshine, et cetera. We've gotten no responses from him, so we don't know what's happened there. But anyway, so we know that the board will be looking at all, the board of the Left Forum is going to be looking at all of our panels and deciding whether they're going to allow them or not, so we'll see what happens.
Date and place for this Left Forum?
Yes, thank you. June 2nd to the 4th at John Jay College in New York City.
Okay. Okay, other announcements? Well,
this is Wayne. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Wayne, go ahead.
Well, this is actually a follow-on to what Cheryl just said. Cheryl, in light of these letters, is there something other people can do to support these? Over.
Well, yeah, Kat and I tried, we talked about that, and we thought if they approve our panels, then we're okay. If they don't and they start to kick someone out, then we may ask people to, you know, support us in that and send some letters or do something. But we didn't want to aggravate the Left Forum ahead of time if they're going to approve of them. So we're not sure how that's going to. And what they said they might do is just, and they, like, you know, we have a panel with 2 people. They might kick Kevin Barrett out and let us go with the panel with the people they like or something. So
ooh.
I don't know how that's going to work. And they may approve all of them. I don't know. You know, we'll have to see. So
Cheryl, I'll just tell you that what I'm going to do is I've received emails from Marcus asking me to, if I want to do a panel, and I'll say no. I'll just say that I like that I know that my interests will be well represented by panelists that are already there. So. I'll do that. So sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, and we're called the Deep State Track, so they'll know what they're.
Deep,
you know,
State.
If you put that in the Deep State Track, they'll know. And they're like, we've been communicating with them about this for, you know, for a while, so they know it well. So they'll know what you're talking about.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks, Cheryl, for doing this. It's Left Forum's a great thing, and we're going to have tables, and if there are people who are interested in helping man the table, you're looking for volunteers, right?
Yeah, we have some people already, but we could use a few more. But if not, we can cover it. And so if anyone wants to go, they have to pay for a ticket, and that's the problem that's gone up now. So if we had two free tickets to man the table, but we've used those. So
yep, great. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you, Cheryl. Hey, what is the price, by the way, of the ticket?
I don't know. We got a group ticket for $35 for the weekend per person. I think it's gone up to like $65 or $85 if you're not with the group and you're now past the early bird registration. So it's
okay. Thanks. All right. Any other? Okay.
It's on
any
your
other
website if anyone's curious.
Okay. Any other announcements?
I wish I could have taken, this is Lynn Bradbury. It was a great program. I wish I could have taken you up on those free tickets, Cheryl. And also, I just wanted to say that Dwayne Dietz and I thought we were first on the call at 8:02, and it took us a while to figure out we were on the old number. I tried to give him the number that I called in on, but he started to say, "Oh, I've got the number 318 or something." But he did try; he was there, but he had the wrong number. And his email actually said tomorrow's date. So for a while, we thought everybody was thinking it was tomorrow.
Mm.
Okay. Anyway, you'll hear from him. But so he was here anyway, or he tried to be here.
Okay. All right. So thank you, Lynn. Any other announcements? Well, hearing none, then I want to thank everyone for their patience. I know we've gone a little over time tonight, but I think it was well worth it. And we'll see you for the last Wednesday in May, which will be the 31st, I believe, the last day of the month. And we are keeping our fingers crossed. I won't say yet who, but we're hoping to have a very, very special guest. So if that all pans out, it'll be well worth your while to show back up again. So we'll see you all then, and have a great week, great month.
Thank
you. Good night, everybody.
Okay, bye, everyone. Thanks.
Good night.